Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway and I'm reading my way through the Deities and Demigods supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition, and as I do, I'm talking about the gods, monsters, and mythological beings that I find in it, and how to use them and religion and mythology more generally in your fantasy role-playing games. In today's episode, we're continuing our journey through the Greek mythos section of Deities and Demigods, and we're going to talk about a couple of races of giants, or are they? As well as Demeter, the goddess of the harvest, and Dionysus, the god of wine. So let's begin with the Cyclopes. Now, there are two types of Cyclops in Deities and Demigods, and this actually would explain why there's only the Cyclops kin in, I think, Monster Manual 2, this kind of lesser Cyclops, because the originals are here in Deities and Demigods. And you got your greater and your lesser Cyclopes. Basically, one is more intelligent, more capable of making complex things, because the Cyclopes are creators. They build things. Hence the term Cyclopean, which H.P. Lovecraft was so fond of, which means, of course, like huge blocks of stone, such as would be found in something built by giants. The Cyclopes play kind of two slightly different roles in Greek mythology and Greek literature, and this ties in with the idea that there are two different versions of them in the Deities and Demigods book, although the origins for the greater Cyclopes, that they were created by Hephaestus and given to Hera, doesn't make a lot of sense since, I hope I'm remembering that correctly, but it doesn't make a lot of sense because the Cyclopes play a role in Greek mythology that really predates that kind of thing happening, right? So they are there before Zeus and his brothers conquer the previous generation of deities, the Titans, and take over Olympus. In fact, they created Zeus's weapon, the Thunderbolt, as well as the Cap of Darkness that allowed Hades to become invisible, and the Trident of Poseidon. So the Cyclopes were imprisoned by Uranus, and Zeus let them out in exchange for their help in producing weapons when he decided to rebel against his father, Cronus. So once again, we have this idea of kind of a primordial power being locked up and then being released because it can be used. This is something that we see with giants in other types of mythology. So giants in Norse mythology are also builders. Famously, there's the story of the giants building the walls of Asgard and then, you know, falling out with Odin over the payment. So the emphasis is on the strength and size of these creatures, which makes sense. It relates to the idea that they make these magnificent things. But then we also have the Cyclops that most people are probably familiar with, which is Polyphemus, the Cyclops in the Odyssey. And when Odysseus encounters the Cyclops, he's quite different. He is definitely large and powerful, but he's much more kind of ogre-ish, a primitive creature, uncivilized, you know, living on this island, tending his flock. You know, not an animal, but certainly kind of a primitive man and someone that someone like Odysseus would look down on, you know, not someone that a king like Odysseus would consider to be his equal. A far cry from creatures who made weapons for the gods. Now, I'm not sure that those stories are intended to form two consistent parts of a coherent mythos. Indeed, I'm reasonably certain that they are not intended to form two consistent parts of a coherent mythos. But as always, this story appeals to me. The only problem with it is that the thing that, like, it sort of suggests is the thing that I always do, which is to have a once great civilized species that was capable of manufacturing these incredible things, and that is now, you know, reduced to some shadow of its former glory. Maybe Zeus realized that the tremendous power of the Cyclopes, if he had used it against the Titans, well, perhaps that power could one day be turned against him. So instead of imprisoning them, he did something to make them forget or lose the knowledge that they once held. And if you wanted to overthrow the gods, you'd have to figure out some way to restore to the weapon-creating Cyclopes their knowledge of either making new weapons that could threaten a god, or of the weaknesses of the weapons that they gave to the gods. Fighting the gods has been on my mind since I read, and I'm probably mispronouncing this, Carandun, a role-playing game with the subtitle Make God Bleed, in which you are very like built into the premise of the game is the idea that you're going to ultimately attack and destroy God. So anyway, yeah, the Cyclopes are fine. I think there's a use for them. The most famous story about the Cyclopes is, of course, from one of the classic adventure story narratives. So they'd be relatively easy to fit into a D&D game. The only thing that I would say is that the lesser Cyclopes, the kind of brute Cyclopes, basically already overlap conceptually with hill giants or even ogres, you know. It's sort of the same thing, but with fewer eyes. All right, next up we have Demeter. Now, Demeter is one of those deities who kind of receives short shrift in D&D and things like it, because Demeter was a very important deity to the ancient Greeks. And there are quite a lot of, like, you know, hymns in praise of her and festivals in her honor. And of course, she's the deity at the center of the Eleusinian Mysteries, this mystery cult, this initiatory, not secret society, but unlike the kind of public civic nature of most Greek religion, the Mysteries were an initiatory thing where, you had to go through certain processes to become part of it. And Demeter was at the center of these. And there's this idea, of course, that as a harvest goddess, as a goddess of grain and of food, these cycles of agricultural productivity are seen as kind of like a symbol for the immortality of the soul. So the earth bears fruit and then appears to die, but then in the spring, life is rekindled again. So could it not be that mortals, when they appear to die, perhaps at some future time, life will return to them? I don't know, but that's the theory. But also, in a society where agriculture is at the heart of the routines of daily life, of the survival of the community, where even the wealthiest person is much more in tune with the fundamentals of food production and land management than, like a middle class person today. Obviously, an agricultural or grain goddess would be given great importance. But in gaming products and in computer games and in movies, Demeter tends not to get the respect that she was accorded in ancient Greek society, presumably because although a grain goddess is tremendously important, she isn't very exciting. Indeed, probably the most famous story of Demeter is one that is sort of tangential to a myth that isn't really about her, which is, of course, the story of Hades and Persephone. When Hades takes away her daughter, Persephone, Demeter wanders and wanders looking for her and has all these sort of encounters. It reminds me, of course, it's connected to, I guess, I'm not a comparative religion person, but this seems to me obvious that they are connected, that the story of Dumuzi's sister looking for him in the story where Dumuzi is taken into the underworld. Again, that goes back to the idea that, the winter, the time that the crops are not growing, is somehow a dead time. But that what happened to Persephone until a compromise was reached kind of threw the natural balance out of whack, right? Demeter was distracted from her duties, and therefore the natural cycle of food production was not happening, which of course would have disastrous consequences for an ancient society. Because agricultural land ownership is, again, a big part of the economies of most ancient Greek communities, she is also the mother of wealth. Literally, one of her children is Pluto's wealth. So she's seen as a bountiful goddess, not just literally in terms of the bounty of, like, grain, but also figuratively in that, like, all other wealth springs from her. So Demeter, like, as always, while I was writing this episode, I was looking up material about the gods and goddesses on places like Perseus, and Demeter turns up quite a lot. For example, we get references to public treasuries being located within the temple of Demeter, or people, in texts that have nothing to do with Demeter, just records of people going, by Demeter. But there are also a lot of texts that are directly about Demeter. So probably the most famous is Homeric Hymn 13. This is from the translation by Gregory Nagy, or Naj. I don't know how Hungarian Gregory likes it to be. I begin to sing of Demeter, the holy goddess with the beautiful hair, and her daughter too, the one with the delicate ankles, whom Hades seized. She was given away by Zeus the loud thunderer, the one who sees far and wide. Demeter did not take part of this, she of the golden double axe. she who glories in the harvest. And then Persephone is taken away, and Demeter hears her cry. And the lady mother heard her, and a sharp Akos seized her heart. The headband on her hair she tore off with her own immortal hands, and threw a dark cloak over her shoulders. She sped off like a bird, soaring over land and sea, looking and looking. But no one was willing to tell her the truth, not one of the gods, not one of the mortal humans, not one of the birds, messengers of the earth. Thereafter, for 9 days, did the Lady Demeter wander all over the earth, holding torches ablaze in her hands. Not once did she take of ambrosia and nectar sweet to drink in her grief, nor did she bathe her skin in water. But when the 10th bright dawn came upon her, Hecate came to her, holding a light ablaze in her hands. She came with a message, and she spoke up, saying to her, Lady Demeter, bringer of Horai, giver of splendid gifts, which one of the gods who dwell in the sky, or which one of mortal humans, sees Persephone, and brought grief to your Philos Tumos? I don't know what this stuff means. But she is constantly referred to throughout this as a, let's see, so she's called a Lady Mother, obviously, a queen, O Lady resplendent with gifts, Demeter, the one with the dark robe, Holy Demeter, she with the beautiful garlands in her hair. At the end of the story, the situation is resolved. You know, Persephone's going to spend half the year underground. And Rhea, who is Demeter's mother, comes and speaks to her and says, Come, child, Zeus the loud thunderer, the one who sees far and wide, is summoning you to come to the company of that special group of gods. And he promised Timae that he would give you what you could receive in the company of the mortal gods. Some of the Greek words here are untranslated, and I don't know what they mean. He assented that your daughter, every time the season comes around, would spend a third portion of the year in the realms of dark mist underneath, and the other two-thirds in your company and that of the other immortals. He has assented to all this with the nod of his head. So come, my child, obey. Do not be too stubborn in your anger at the dark, clouded son of Kronos. Straightway, make the harvest grow, that life-bringer for humans. So she spoke. And Demeter, she with the beautiful garlands in her hair, did not disobey. Straight away she sent up the harvest from the land with its rich clods of earth, and all the wide earth with leaves and blossoms was laden. Then she went to the kings, administrators of Themistes, and she showed them, to Triptolemus, to Diocles, driver of horses, to powerful Eumolpus, and to Kelios, leader of the people. She revealed to them the way to perform the sacred rites, and she pointed out the ritual to all of them, the holy ritual, which it is not at all possible to ignore, to find out about, or to speak out. The great awe of the gods holds back any speaking out. And then it goes on to say, But whoever is uninitiated in the rites, whoever takes no part in them, will never get a share of these sorts of things, once they die, down below in the dark realms of mist. So again, we have this sense of Demeter as a very, very powerful goddess, and once again, one associated with this secret initiation. These are the Eleusinian mysteries. This is the myth where that comes from. And one of the other things that keeps coming up, you know, when you look for Demeter is the reference to the idea that revealing the secrets of Demeter, revealing the secrets of the Eleusinian mysteries, is a very serious crime. Another hymn to Demeter is Orphic Hymn 40 or Orphic Hymn 39. There seem to be two different numbering schema. I think 39 is the older one and 40 is the more current one, but I don't know. And anyway, that's where this reference to Demeter driving around in a chariot drawn by two dragons comes from. It's mentioned in there. Okay, so that's Demeter. Very, very important goddess in ancient Greek religion. Maybe not given her full due in Deities and Demigods. Speaking of which, let's talk about Dionysus. Like, I know I just got done talking about one set of initiatory mystery cults and one god whose product was immensely important to ancient society, but here comes another one, Dionysus, god of wine. Again, I feel like the Deities and Demigods description of Dionysus is fairly accurate, including the idea that he has these kind of positive and negative aspects, in the same way that, you know, a society would tend to view wine, because wine on the one hand has these good qualities, it gets you drunk, and then on the other hand, it has this bad quality that it gets you drunk. You know, and this is something that we've seen, this kind of, like, now reverence is not the right word, but there's certainly, when we're talking about religious experience, there's a fascination with kind of mind-altering substances. And this is something that doesn't come up a huge amount in role-playing games. Adventurers go to the tavern and they quaff some flagons of foaming ale, and, you know, maybe they get comedy drunk. But the idea of altered states of consciousness being important in religious experience is not really something that comes up very often in RPGs. You might get like a seer, often an NPC, you know, wafting some fumes into their nostrils and going into some kind of prophetic trance, but it's not often something that player characters do. I assume this is because no one wants to be seen as making a role-playing game that promotes drug abuse. I mean, you know, fair enough. But it's definitely true that intoxication is only one of a number of ways in which ancient societies altered their mind states, and that was sometimes seen as sacred. Another thing that's kind of missing from the description of Dionysus is that he is followed by these groups of satyrs and maenads, revelers, but also violent characters who, you know, on the one hand, satyrs are like party animals, literally. They're, you know, they're the ultimate good time boys, but they can turn very dangerous in the same way that a room full of drunks could be your best friends right up to the point where a brawl breaks out. If you look at the mythology of Dionysus, a lot of it involves kind of unintended consequences. There are all these stories about how, you know, he goes and he visits some particular king, and then disaster erupts, even though that's not really what Dionysus was trying to achieve. He just has this effect by being around. This seems appropriate to a party of role-playing game characters. I do think that a cleric of the God of Wine is actually a pretty good map to the typical Dungeons & Dragons character of the cleric, except that clerics are usually portrayed as either neutrally beneficent types who love all and heal all, or stodgy defenders of the social order who want to, like, burn the witch, we shall cleanse the earth with fire. And I don't feel like that's what a cleric of Dionysus would be like, but there should definitely be that duality, right? The rosy-cheeked, old, holy person with the garlands in their hair that, you know, bathes your injured limbs and casts cure light wounds on you, and the armored figure that takes up their mace of disruption to go bust some heads when it's time to throw down, represent that duality within the Church of Dionysus. Now, one could argue that that duality is present in all of these religions, right? We've seen how Ares is associated with healing in some cases, or Apollo, who's both the god of, you know, medicine and the god of plague. But Dionysus, more than any of these other gods, or as much as any of them anyhow, seems to be about that duality, that it recognizes and celebrates that duality. The strangeness of that duality is important to this character. And, you know, clerics in Dungeons & Dragons have that very dual role. This is an interesting thing because it's designed around a principle that makes good, sound, practical sense. You know, if we're going to have a game where healing can get characters who would otherwise die back up onto their feet, which is, you know, less a feature of earlier editions and more a feature of later ones, then you want to make sure that clerics are highly survivable. So they have good armor class and a lot of hit points. When you take the healing cleric specialization in 5th edition, you gain proficiency in heavy armor. Why? Because it's important for healers to have good armor. You know, it makes game mechanical sense. But I like the idea of a divinity that recognizes that it's really weird to heal with one hand and kill with the other, and then says, you know, life is weird, the human spirit is weird, the gods are weird. These dualities of compassion and cruelty exist within all of mankind. Most of the people in the middle of the road don't go around doing middlingly good things all the time. They do both good things and evil things. Something like what a neutral god would be like. You know, maybe that duality itself, that strangeness, that wonder, is something worth celebrating, for the gods did not make humans to be wholly good nor wholly evil. And if what you're looking for is some kind of mystical enlightenment, then that cannot be found by embracing just one or the other. It is in releasing the sort of strictures of civilized behavior that one expresses most fully what it means to be human. The acts of drunken spontaneity can include acts of violence, they can include acts of hatred, but they can also include acts of love, of generosity, of compassion. And the classic thing for a drunk person to say is, "You're my best friend. I love you, man." What if your cleric just really believed that. Everyone else kind of, we have an accepted social understanding that when someone says, I love you, man, you're my best friend, when they're drunk, you're just like, oh, that's cool. Yeah, this means we're bros, but I'm not intending to take it seriously. But what if your cleric of Dionysus is the kind of person who just takes the things that drunk people say seriously, right? He's going to say both of them. I love you, man. You're my best friend. Or alternatively, let's go. I'll fight you all, one at a time or all together. You can't talk to me like that. Dang, now I want to play a cleric of Dionysus. Strive to act as if you were drunk all the time, not like stumbling around or falling down, but confronting the world with your filters removed. All those things that say, let's slow down and think about this. Not if we're going to serve the God of Wine truthfully. All right, Cleric of the God of Wine going on my next D&D game. So, having once again talked myself into liking something, in this case a deity, we're going to bring this episode to the close. In our next episode, we're going to be continuing our journey through the gods and goddesses of Greek mythology. And I hope you join me then for Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.